Yeah, it's also like, I think that as far as the voice, one thing I've noticed kind of in the similar vein is like a lot of schooled artists, they just never kind of built that mentality of what you're trying to say. It's like me in my development or whatever, it was always kind of what I'm trying to say and then how to do that was always kind of the process.
Hello and welcome to episode 19 of Lo-Fi Podcast. I am John Wentz, recording conversations with artists, musicians, and filmmakers while in confinement in Paris, France. Just a couple of things before we get started. I want to thank everybody for tuning in and listening. Been getting a lot of new listeners and some great emails, so thank you again for that. If you can, take the time, give a review on Apple Podcasts. I don't take pride in asking that, but you know, it really, really does help. And I have some exciting projects for the future, and getting up there in the ranks is definitely going to help to achieve those. Again, we'll be doing 2 episodes per week, shooting for every Monday and every Friday. Later this week, we're going to have Robin Waddy from the band Big Brave. I'm really excited to release that episode. Coming up in the next couple of weeks, we'll have Guru Skomsnismoe from Oslo, Norway, from the band Moe. Amazing, amazing band. I'm really excited to release both those episodes. Have painter Benjamin Garcia and Ray Bonilla. And today, the one and only Joshua Lawyer. Before getting started, too, I have to apologize for some loss in audio quality. As you can imagine, and I'm sure it's everywhere, the internet is seeming really bogged down. And I've noticed in the last couple of weeks a decline in the audio quality when interviewing guests. And of course, I'm doing this in confinement, so I do it over the internet. But rest assured, the information is there. They're going to be great interviews. Just have to put up with a little bit of loss in quality. So I do apologize for that. Without further delay, Joshua Lawyer is a painter, muralist, and one half of the podcast Waiting to Dry, hailing from Northern California. In this episode, we discuss his beginnings as a graffiti artist turned painter, being an autodidact, the importance of story in art, and much more. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did with Joshua Lawyer.
How's the digital working for you?
I mean, I like it. I have no complaints, actually. Yeah. At this point, if I could somehow make a living just doing digital for a year, I would totally do it.
Huh,
I don't miss oils at all, but I mean, our flat's really small and I really miss outside. So I'm just going nuts, man.
But how are people going to know you're an artist if you don't have paint on your clothes? You know what I mean?
I don't know. I'm still working that. I'm thinking about like mini iPhone screens all over my shirt with just digital paint splashes.
Nice. Genius.
Yeah.
I've been playing around with digital at least a little bit for mural type stuff.
Nice.
Just trying to create designs that I might want to do in the future.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's still, I don't know. It's still working out all those kinks and trying to figure out. I think in that, like when I see your digital work, there's kind of, I wouldn't say a seamless transfer, but there's a connection between the two that's very visible. Mm-hmm. You know, I could see each being John Wentz's work. With me, it's like the medium seems to be dictating what I can do with it. At least so far, I haven't really worked out. I'm comfortable in it. Which is kind of the deal with, I think, most mediums. You know, I think in like 2 years, I might be very comfortable.
Yeah. What is it that holds you back with it? Like what particularly?
I think I just kind of jump into it and play around. And then there's always like, I don't know. I think, you know, I used to do more mixed medium stuff and then I moved to oil painting.
Yeah.
I think there was like about a year and a half to 2 years where I was just kind of figuring out the medium and not really kind of pursuing anything that I actually wanted to paint. It was more just like figuring out how to be happy with what I'm creating.
In oils.
In an aesthetic way. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, when you switched over.
Yeah.
And why did you switch over? What was...
There was limitations to what I was doing when I was doing mixed medium stuff. And I kind of looked around and really focused on whose stuff I thought wasn't that limited by the medium. And I kept seeing oil as the main medium. So I decided to give it a stab, and I played with it before and I liked it, but for some reason I just kind of stopped. Well, yeah. I have my reasons why I stopped.
Why?
I had a gallery destructure back in the day.
Oh, that's right. I forgot that's a common thread we have.
Yeah, and I went in with my sketchbook and I was like, oh, like I didn't know they were like a thing. I just had my sketchbook on me. And I was like, oh, this is cool. Like, would you guys be willing to show my work? And they looked at my sketchbook and they were like, oh, this is cool. Can you show us some of your paintings? So I brought paintings in. And when I did, they were like, oh, your drawings are way better than your sketches. And that kind of influenced me when I was pretty young at the time. So I kind of just detoured from what I was doing to, or what I was like in the painting kind of realm. And I mean, I think it was a benefit in the long run because it really helped me get really good at just drawing and focusing on drawing, because even my paintings were based around just really getting good at drawing. So now when I paint, I think that's it's just such a useful tool for me, just having that that comfort in drawing.
Yeah. Well, it should be the basis of everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah. You know, I'm not classically trained, so I just take a weird wonky route to everything.
yeah What were the, that's interesting, man. Like, most of the people I've interviewed on the podcast are self-taught, which is interesting in itself, but for people that are self-taught, like, what were the big hurdles in oil for you? Because I feel like for me I don't think I ever used oils before school, so I have no like from day one it was like. And I remember my first teacher was really kind of a dick about things, but and luckily so in the end, but it's like, this goes here, this goes here, this goes here. Right. I know no other way.
I don't know. It was just kind of, there's a thing I think with artists where there's a bit of kind of like effortlessness. In like most genres, you know, like if you listen to Nina Simone sing and you watch her sing, there's like it doesn't seem like she's trying. She's just kind of doing it. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. It's like that thing about virtuosity. They make it look easy. Right. True virtuous. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think with oil painting, I don't think I was doing much different then than I am now. It's more about me kind of being comfortable in like doing what I'm doing, which ends up feeling less stiff and, you know, just kind of being able to play around more in the medium rather than worrying about if things will work or not.
That just made me think of something. It seems like with you, you're definitely one of those self-learners. Uh-huh. It seems, I mean, you had no art education. You guys start the podcast. You do that from scratch. Like, you're really good at self-learning. Was there a hallmark of like how you grew up, how you were taught, what were the circumstances? Cause I feel like that is the same with everybody. Like, for instance, like for me, I noticed, something I got from my childhood was we grew up really poor. Mm-hmm. And so when my parents, like they always made sure I was able to do the same things. Like I was, you know, got into bike racing,
right.
But I always had to use the worst materials. So right. I developed this habit now of, and which is a good thing because I know how to milk something before I move on or invest into it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, definitely my environment was not a environment that was like encouraging of arts at all. I just, I grew up extremely poor and,
Where'd you grow up?
Bounced around a lot, but, San Mateo, East Palo Alto, and then Central Valley. And so all the Bay Area, except for the Central Valley, I lived in a place called Los Baños, which, and the name holds up because there's always like cow shit wafting through the town. It's just like,
it's a rough drive.
It lives, yeah, it lives up to the name of the bathrooms.
Yeah.
But yeah, I lived in those three spots for the majority of my life and was always just kind of the poor kid, but always drew, you know, those, they always seemed like those, like the kids that would draw in class, you know, and I was always, and then, but yeah, I can't learn like in a classroom setting. That's just not how my brain works.
Yeah.
So I wish I could, but it's just, there's something. So my dad was pretty much like a lifelong criminal, you know, for the most of his life.
Okay.
And I don't know if it's a genetic thing, but there's something about when someone tells me how to do something that like my instant reaction is, don't tell me what to do. Now I want to do the opposite.
It's called a contrarian. Yeah.
Exactly. And so there's like this, it's like mandatory for me to teach myself these things, but it ends up being, I think, a longer lesson than it has to be a lot of times. But
I can relate to that.
Yeah.
But it does. It ends up to be a longer one, but in a way, that's the only way it's going to get through.
Right.
So don't you think you have to experience it? Because I thought of that actually listening to one of your guys' episodes, and I want to talk to you a bit because we messaged about the idea of story. Mm-hmm. But you were talking like relating it to biblical things and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And it's a weird tangential connection. But it made me think of that, like, because those stories are lesson based. And I'm that same way in that, like, for me to learn, I always take the long way around.
Right.
Yeah, but I'm like, why can't I just listen to everybody? Even when people are right, I'm like, man, I could have just said, like, okay, I think you're right and gone with it. But I have to learn it for myself.
Yeah, definitely. And one of the few ways I can learn is kind of through story and like the parable form of, you know, of a lesson. So if you can kind of relate it to something that makes sense in the real world, all of a sudden I'm like, oh yeah, I'll take that on. And there's also like, you know, I've worked in a lot of dangerous environments for like my job. And you learn that there are some people who you just kind of trust because they seem to know their shit. You know, so you value their lessons much more than they're just someone trying to tell you something.
Yeah.
It's, and you have to kind of like build that trust, at least for me, before I can take your word and actually learn that lesson. So even then, it still takes a while just to kind of be able to be taught by someone.
Right. Yeah, but that makes sense. You're going to trust experience over anything else.
Yeah, for sure. So... Yeah. But yeah, the whole story thing is something I'm definitely obsessed with, at least right now, as far as pursuing art and kind of, I know we've had similar conversations, but it just keeps like the idea of it just keeps growing in my head.
What define the idea of story for you? And I'm also curious, when did this come about? Cause I remember because I listen to your podcast regularly and these things slowly come up.
Yeah.
But I can't pinpoint when it was. When was it and what's your definition of it?
So, okay. So the big breakthrough for me was like the podcast actually helped a lot because you're forced to have these really intense conversations with people a lot of times. And Nadezhda, do you know Nadezhda?
Yes. Yeah. She, not personally, but.
We had her on the podcast and she talked about really focusing in on the work that you enjoy, artwork in all forms, and then trying to pinpoint the determining, like the defining factor of that art form or like linking, you know, music and movies and books are always going to, I mean, even books, it's like, I don't like biographical books at all. Like, those can kind of like, they're just not for me. There has to be a bit of make believe or something.
Watch the pounding.
God damn it. I'm like
you're King, like a Southern preacher.
I'm King Kong in this bitch. Hands are in pocket.
Okay.
Yeah, so that kind of really, I sat down and I wrote down just all, I took like days and days just writing down favorite books, favorite movies, favorite artists, favorite whatever. And then I really focused in on what I really enjoy about what they do. And that kind of, first it explained the type of story that I really enjoy. And then from there, then I kind of, that kind of sparked the idea. I got to put my hands back in my pocket. That kind of sparked the idea. And then from there, I started really focusing in on how to tell a story through art. And then I think there's a lot of pitfalls with, I don't know, being tacky or cheesy or too over the top with, you know, going a narrative route.
Yeah.
And so I really tried to focus on how things are being used to tell a story in art and how to maximize things that I think are really interesting and really useful. And then figuring out kind of the story worth telling. I mean, I haven't changed the story I'm telling. It's just kind of rethinking how I'm telling it. There's a couple poets I really like that are like modern day poets, but a lot of what they do, or a lot of poetry in general, is kind of similar to art in that you have to whittle things down to the most, to the simplest form and as condensed as possible. So you want to use the least amount of words to say the most amount possible. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
And so I think like 2 years ago, maybe a year, I after kind of going through this idea of connecting poetry with art, I decided to do, I was supposed to do a show, so I decided to build a show around Charles Bukowski's poem called The Laughing Heart. And mm-hmm. the reason why is because like every line can stand alone. There's you know, it's just like a very, so it kind of set up the titles for each painting. And then I would have to challenge myself to try to tell that story of that line through each painting just to kind of understand or get better at telling stories. That's kind of what the path I've been on is how to tell a story good through art.
Mm-hmm.
And really trying to focus in on things, tools we have to do what we do and kind of seeing the pitfall. So I think one of the big pitfalls, at least in my opinion, is artists kind of being obsessed with trends or what it's like the equivalent to like a movie using too much special effects and not having any substance. You know, it's like, cool, you guys spent $100 million on a shit movie.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of Marvel movies.
Yeah. So it's like that idea of like, we can kind of get too lost in like the dazzling effects of our pieces, I think. Not saying that that's not a net. I mean, we all want to make cool shit at the end of the day, you know, things that we're like, that's cool. But I think we can get lost in kind of why something has to exist to tell a story. If that's your goal, I mean, people can do whatever the fuck they want. I'm just trying to figure out what I think is worth pursuing. And I think having something, so the idea is, I mean, it's so like, I think we've talked about this and in my mind is like, I feel like in like a million different sections, it's all like circling. So I might be very scatterbrained.
No, it's all good.
There's something about when you hear a song and it like instantly like takes you back to a place or instantly, even if the song is new, if it can kind of connect with you on some personal life stuff, that's that to me is like a interesting, that's like, to me, almost, I don't know if it's, it is or it might be, but it's, it seems like it's one of the most greatest tools of art in general. The ability to connect with human beings, even if the story has nothing in common. You know, I think I was talking to you before, or messaged you before, about Malcolm Gladwell. And how he had this like idea that songs have to be very specific for you to, for them to be good or something like that.
Yeah.
And I disagree. And the reason I disagree is, and I think this is another issue with painters, is because you're forcing the artist to almost think through the viewer or listener's, point of view. So a lot of times with art and like specifically, you'll hear a lot of artists say like, whatever you see is what it's about. You know what I mean? Like that, whatever you, the viewer sees,
in your interpretation.
Yeah. That's what it's about. And I disagree with that whole idea. I think what it is I think you should create your art and people are going to connect on it based on their own experience, or they might not connect with it, but that doesn't devalue what the songwriter wrote the song about and why they wrote it. You know what I mean? Like, just because they shouldn't think of the listener in a way of like, how can I make sure that they feel like I'm talking about them kind of mindset. I think they need to write what they, it's like the whole like write what you know mentality, you know, write what you think is what you figured out yourself in some story form, and then hopefully someone.
But are you talking about, I don't know if I'm understanding it fully, like, are you talking about kind of pandering to the audience, like thinking about what will they connect to, as opposed to what is my story about, whether they connect to it or not?
Well, I think there's a bit of a cop out in the art world where it's like, I don't want to put myself out there and tell you what this painting is about. I would rather you decide what you think the painting is about, kind of mentality. And I think there's a flaw in that, because I think it's almost like let me go back to like songwriting. If someone wrote a song about a breakup and someone else feels that because of their breakup, that doesn't mean that the musician doesn't go like, this is based around a breakup I had where it really hurt me. You know what I mean? It's like, it's almost like that's a perfectly okay conversation to have. It just seems like a lot of times artists aren't willing to have that conversation, because I think there is this weird pressure of having your art mean something that's like a bit taboo, a bit like, oh, well, you should leave it open to everyone's interpretation and whatever. And it's like, that's fine, but I still
really have to. You think that? I feel the opposite.
What? That everyone can have their interpretation?
That you're supposed to, that you're supposed to have a story.
I think so. I think that.
No, but I mean, that's what I feel from other people. Like when you're saying it's like a taboo, that hasn't been my experience.
Oh, really?
I don't know. My experience is you should not be vague. Like that's a total cut. Like you're saying, it's a cop out.
I don't know. I always feel like every time I talk to artists, I always get the same, like, it's, you know, like it's whatever. Like it's a very loose, it's very rare where someone's like, this is about this. I mean, I don't know what pressures are coming from any other places like galleries or things. But whenever I talk to artists, there's always a vague explanation for their work. There's very little that they want to talk about as far as like why they created what they created, like what the meaning is or whatever behind the painting. It just always seems like it's a very subtle, like, I don't want to say because I don't want to seem lame, but maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think you're right. Or it's just because it's not there. I mean, I think, and perhaps I'm wrong, but the way I think in the, I'll say like the arena that we're in of artists, it can be so technique based that you just forget about it. It's like blinders.
Right.
You know, or like you said, I think a part of it is trend has a lot to do with it. And if you're jumping on a trend, then of course you don't have any
Right.
Yeah, story behind it.
Yeah, it's always, the trends are always funny. I feel like we're going to see a lot of still lifes coming soon.
Of toilet paper?
Of anything.
Why? Just because everybody's painting at home?
No, I think there's some really awesome, I think what happens with trends is there's some people that do it amazing, and then everyone's like, I want to try, and then they try, and then it becomes a thing.
Oh, okay. Is there a still life trend? I don't think
I'm making a prediction. I feel like I see some artists doing it, and I'm like, okay, I think this might, I think, what's the lady's name? Zoe something. She paints like sandwiches.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they're like amazing. And for some reason,
Zoe Frank. Like, yeah, she's amazing. Yeah.
And I think she's kind of like she's one of the like artists that's kind of like making everyone turn to like, ooh, a sandwich can be awesome. I want to try that.
And oh, okay, yeah.
And I think that'll kind of happen soon. I think everyone's kind of tired of painting people or something. Probably not, but
I trust your predictions because I remember I think you predicted Parasite was going to get the Academy Award. So
nice.
You have a little Nostradamus in you.
Yeah. I mean, what happens is there's these artists that kind of move things a notch forward, and then everyone follows suit. And that goes to like. Back to kind of the pitfalls of trying to create something for, you know, like that of what you're trying to say. I think it's very easy to see what everyone's doing and then like be really, I'm very tempted when I see other people's work to go like, I want to try that. I want to,
sure, yeah.
You know, that thing I want to do. And kind of, I think this also goes back to really focusing on storytelling as a way to steer the ship, because you can't, if style or whatever you want to call it is dictating what you're doing, you're going to be all over the place. But if you have a story you're trying to tell, it kind of forces you to stay focused on the path you're going rather than being persuaded by, you know, things happening around you. And I think that's the point of finding a story you think is worth telling. Because I mean, if you have a shitty story or whatever, then it is what it is. I mean, you might still fall to the style of the day, but if you have a clear direction of where you're trying to go, I think that you can really kind of stay focused and keep your blinders on and do what you're trying to do, rather than being influenced. And I mean, that's the tricky part, especially today with, you know, the platforms or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I think. I mean, that's a positive to kind of keep you on track. It really seems like a helpful tool for that.
Story. Yeah. Yeah. Totally. And I, in our discussions, I remember in like DMing, and I don't know if I was coming across, but I was also interpreting story as concept, because sure, there's those levels, right? So there can be the illustrative complete narrative story. Right. And I think what you're talking about, and then concept. And I think those kind of are closer together.
Yeah.
And it's that same idea that with that idea, if you have a strong concept, the technique should absolutely follow.
Right. Yeah. Or hopefully you've built the technique to accomplish that concept in a way that
doesn't. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird balance because, okay, so a lot of ideas I have about telling story through paintings are based around, you know, obviously how, so, I mean, we've all kind of done this where we want to lead the eye, you know, from one thing to the next and kind of pay. And so I've been showing artists like my work, and every time I do, all I do is watch their face to see where their eyes are led and to see if I'm succeeding, because the idea is most stories are, you know, work in a linear path. So, I mean, this goes away from kind of the concept thing, but so through a painting, everything is on that one, you know, it's like a one still, still shot or whatever of the entire thing I want to say. So yeah. The only way I can kind of control that is by figuring out how to lead an eyeball from one thing to another to kind of explain things as good as I can. And this does kind of fall under, I don't know, maybe it's a narrative thing, like an illustrative narrative thing. I'm not sure. But it's also trying to use things that I think are interesting in painting. So it's not necessarily for like a person just trying to read a book or something. It's more like trying to lead the eye through like interesting techniques or something like that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
What are the things you find interesting? Because you said using the things that you find interesting.
I don't know. Just like, you know, playing like obvious. A lot of the stuff I do has really rendered moments to it, and so I think for most people, the like rendered face is always going to kind of be the first thing everyone looks at.
Yeah,
and then going from there and kind of breaking. I don't know. It's not really breaking rules, but it's just doing the unexpected. I that's what I find most interesting in a lot of work is like, oh, they went left when you thought they should go right, you know, and trying mm-hmm. to figure out those little things to kind of say, oh, I wonder why they did this or I wonder why they did that. Another thing I've found useful is I know you talked a little bit with Chris Lieb about light source. And so like on the big piece I worked on, I wanted a contradiction of light sources to happen, where what seemed to be the light source didn't cast the shadow. So it was kind of mm-hmm. like this idea of just like obviously we're not seeing. It's just the idea of a contradiction playing a part in a story, and how, especially for paintings, it's like. It's a way to explain something that might seem one way, but isn't actually that. So mm-hmm. light source seems to be a thing. It's also like, I don't know. I have all these like mini ideas. I'm still working on putting them all together, but it's like the idea of an antagonist. I think some of the most interesting stories happen to be where antagonists aren't 100% evil, I guess, is the best way to put that.
No, the ambiguity, yeah, or like the the fallen hero type stories or things like that.
So it's a lot of artists call it the tension or whatever. Usually tension is the antagonist to most paintings. So, you know, like Homer's fisherman on the boat with the big ass wave is like, obviously the big ass wave is the antagonist in that, you know. So trying to figure out, but no one's saying the ocean is evil. It's just being the ocean. So trying to figure out these moments in life where there's tension and maybe heartache or whatever, but trying to figure out how to make it so it's not so black and white, good and evil, is another thing I'm trying to tackle at the moment. It's a tricky thing to do when you have a single image to kind of convey that.
Yeah, because I was going to ask like what your influences are, because it sounds very cinematic the way you're talking about it. So getting that on one surface,
right? Yeah,
is the challenge.
Yeah. I mean, this goes back to like all the influences that I find that throughout all forms of art. So like poetry. And how they can whittle something down to a very short sentence, but it means a lot. Uh-huh. So it's kind of like, and a lot of the work I'm trying to do is kind of built to lean on each other a bit. So not necessarily be connected in story, but help each other out so that hopefully the viewer can kind of connect more dots than with the single scene. I mean, I'm definitely never going to try to make a movie. It seems like a whole headache, but.
Oh, of course. But you have to be able to draw influences.
Yeah. Probably, yeah. Don't you? Sure. Yeah. I mean, I love watching movies.
You guys talk about cinema a lot on your podcast.
Yeah, Sergio doesn't watch anything, which is frustrating.
I know. I feel like a majority of the episodes are you trying not to spoil movies for Sergio. Yeah, and then telling him where he can illegally watch it.
Hey, let me know if you need the link. I love cinema. I love music. Those are probably like the two biggest art forms that I take, other than like painting. I'm probably on Instagram way too much, but
are you a scroller?
Yeah, I scroll a lot. yeah for sure. And I like watching stories. I'm creeping, if you're not
straight creeping.
But I mean, it's kind of figuring out how to use the art form we have to tell a similar story as cinema and music and all and books and everything has kind of been able to do, but trying to figure that out for myself, you know. That's the thing that I think is the tricky part is it's like if you pay attention to the movies that you like, at least for me, I don't mind a director's hand being present in a film. Mm-hmm. Some people don't like that. And maybe that'll like dictate where the direction you go in your work. If you don't want a director present in their movie, maybe that says something about how you should create your paintings or something like that. But for me, I enjoy seeing the decisions being made by any form of artist, why they decided to do what they did to tell the story they're trying to tell. And trying to kind of bring that back and say, like, all right, what's the story I want to tell? And then how do I think that story should be told? And it's a tricky thing. And there's a lot of moving parts to it in a single shot. So it's really trying to have the idea from the very beginning, from when I photograph my model. So it's like from the second I'm photographing the model, everything's kind of leading to an end result. And I want to have at least the basic the basic story set in place before that, so that I can at least take my best step forward and then go from there and try to build on that image to explain this thing I'm trying to say. And
right. So you start with a loose framework from the beginning, but you're allowing room in the process to it. Do you with that, when you start, like when you have that initial idea, do you do things like, do you write it out? Like things that are non visual?
Yeah, I'll do like a loose, like maybe like 10 sentences of things that I really want to have in the story to say, and it's in my head, but it's like visual cues of like, I need this and I need this thing to work and the lighting to come from this source and whatever it is, it's just, and I'll usually draw it out like with no reference, just kind of draw the pose I want the model to roughly have. And then explain it to her, the idea behind it. So maybe she can add, you know, her skills to whatever I'm doing.
Okay.
And then going from there, I usually write those same kind of things on the painting. So while I'm painting, I'll have that, those notes to kind of keep referencing until I paint over it. But it's just kind of keeping focus on that. And it definitely changes, you know, like, I mean, the story evolves throughout the painting, but this, like, little details to the story evolve, it's like I have the beginning and the end of the story and everything in the middle I'm trying to figure out,
you know. Oh, okay. Yeah, you flesh it out as you go along.
Throughout the process. So some things I'll go, oh, that works perfectly for what I need. And sometimes an idea doesn't read well, so I'll scrap it and try to rework something else to fit the story, but that's that's just part of the creative end of
How do you factor in things like or what role do they play, like something like scale, because you said you've been starting to work bigger. Mm-hmm. How is that a factor in the storytelling and the process, or is it, maybe it's not?
I mean, for me, the scale has allowed me just to kind of not necessarily add more to the painting, but I don't know. It almost feels like I'm writing a novel rather than a short story in a weird way. It just feels like I can add more depth to what I'm doing, more detail. You know, like I'm a big fan of the fuck's his name. I'm so bad at this.
You're a huge fan.
He's a Steinbeck. There you go.
Oh yeah.
I'm a huge fan of Steinbeck, and you know all the books I've audio read. Wink, wink. You know. Yeah. Just edit out the audio part. but there's such a level of description to what he's doing. You know, yeah. So a turtle walking down the road all of a sudden becomes like 10 pages or some shit, you know, or not necessarily.
Yeah. Like no, I know. I feel like when I think of it, it's like Old Man in the Sea.
Right.
You know, wait. Or was that Hemingway? Shit. Yeah. No, I think I'm wrong. I think that was Hemingway. But he had that same way of doing that, like taking something very simplistic and making it extremely interesting.
And I think scale allows a bit of that. It allows a little bit more of us to, like the whole idea of like the unexpected, like it's like little things within the painting to maybe lead the eye or help with, you know, the, I don't know, the overall aesthetic or something. Mm-hmm. You can kind of go in, you can make a simple thing, you can stretch it out to be more complicated through scale.
Right. So then that's got to be, because I, when you initially said that and that how different was for you, I was immediately thought back to your beginning, because you started out doing graffiti and doing walls. Right. But it's an entirely different approach then.
Yeah.
That's
why. Okay. Graffiti doesn't allow a lot of things because a lot of times you're using fat cap. Fast stuff. So it's more like, in a weird way, even though the scale is large, it feels like you're painting on like a 4x4 inch panel because it's just the medium is so restricted.
Right.
And also time. So it's, it just becomes a get in, get out.
Yeah, you have so many different components now with the way you're painting now. There's a lot of more things to juggle.
Exactly. Yeah, and there's time isn't an issue. And and just kind of, things just take way longer, you know, but it, in a good way. But it's been an interesting thing. I don't know. I know you've been kind of thinking about story a bit, right?
Yeah, a lot, actually. I feel like, you know, because I'm realizing now, just I don't know if it's the point I'm at in my life or with art or whatever, that it's the most important thing. Like going back to something you said, and I think I heard this in one of your episodes, maybe you guys are talking about story, but you guys were talking about Bob Dylan and about his voice. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, I forgot what you guys were talking about, but the thing that popped in my head, because I'm a huge Dylan fan, his voice never once bothered me because he was such a fucking great storyteller.
Right.
And actually, in a way, the stories he told, I think he's a great analogy for what we're talking about, because the stories that he told, his voice actually matched that. Because they were bad, horrible. I mean, some of the stories, like there's a song called Moonshiner that was on like one of the bootleg box sets. That's still to this day one of the saddest songs I've ever heard. Hmm. And his inability, in quotes, to sing, I think pushes that forward the same way in like a lot of folk singers, or you listen to like old blues singers,
right?
You know, from the 30s to 40s, Lead Belly. They're not great singers, but they're stretching their limits as much as they can. And in that, I think that small limitation, they can put so much emotion into it. And then the story is just intense.
Right. Yeah. And
you know,
That goes back to, you know, the voice and how if you replace Bob Dylan's voice with like, I don't know, a pop singer or some shit like that.
People who cover Dylan, it's fucking terrible.
Right. it reads inauthentic. And I think that totally. Like, you know, him having the story to guide him. And then the idea is that your style will feel authentic if you're pursuing the path, at least the hope is.
Right? Yeah. If you live the life.
Yeah. Have you seen that? I forget the movie's name, but it has the guy that played in Star Wars. It's about like a bluegrass singer. It's really fucking good.
Which guy? You mean Mark Hamill?
The guy that's like Latin looking. I don't know what he is actually.
Oh, in the new ones.
Yeah.
Those aren't Star Wars.
I'm gonna look it up real quick.
Is that Oscar Isaacs?
Oscar Isaacs. Yeah, you seen
Oscar
that?
Isaac. Yeah. What's the name of the movie? I don't think so.
Let me look it up real quick. But yeah, he plays a blues musician in the, I don't know what time period, but it's just like heartbreaking. And there's a bit of that like failed artist. It's pretty much, yeah, just about him being a failed artist.
Okay.
But his music kind of being respected by his peers, but he just never getting the chance to. And he's actually a phenomenal musician. I watched this before the Star Wars things came out. I was like, this guy's an amazing actor. And then he did the Star Wars, and I was like, can I like him anymore?
I've only seen Ex Machina.
Oh, yeah.
And I forgot what else he did. So I know he's a good dancer.
Man's got hips for days.
He does. He's amazing. I found him sexy. I'm not embarrassed to say it.
It's called Inside Llewyn Davis.
Oh, I've heard of that. Okay. Yeah. I haven't seen it.
It's really good. Highly recommend. So a lot of what a lot of the reason you're going towards story, is that based around like music and your love for it?
And I mean, everything. I'm just starting to see it in everything. I realized, books, things, commercials, like everything has a mini story.
Right.
And then the same as you, I went and started revisiting paintings that I really like. And I was like, man, it's really the story that gets me hooked. Mm-hmm. Down to, those masterclass videos.
Mm-hmm.
Just watching the commercials for those. Right. I'm like, holy shit, it's an encapsulated story.
Right.
Like if you don't have the story, you don't have anything.
Yeah, there's that, like, have you ever seen those like little videos of where they show badly designed doors where they have like a handle where it should be a
yeah.
So like that to me is like it's the door is a story, like if a handle is there to tell you to pull. So it's telling you something. It's telling a short story. So there's these two ideas I've had about stories as far as like art is concerned, which is, at least for me, or three, I guess, narratives that I'm really trying to focus on, which is an object in motion and two objects colliding and an object standing still. Like I'm mm-hmm. really trying to focus on these three bases for stories, which are pretty much endless, and just kind of really figuring out how I can make an impactful story based. I mean, it goes back to, I think you might have heard me say this before, but I have these two narratives I've been talking about forever through my work, which is getting lost and finding home. And mm-hmm. both of those narratives have to do with an object in motion or an object finally stopping, I guess, or standing still. And then when I kind of eliminated the human out of it, it ended up being just kind of these two things. And then the third being a collision, and just trying to figure out how I can tell that story using a human, but only within one frame. It seems like that's the most impactful I can get, are those three narratives. And then building off of those, they just play as a guide to how I start a painting. So I think it's like, what do I want the object to be doing in this piece? And then from there, building.
Yeah, okay.
Like, all right, so this is going to be a painting about stagnation or something like that. So then so the object is still. So then I have to define why the object isn't moving, whether that be I think we were talking about a door. That's why we got on this.
Oh, okay, yeah, the door handle.
The door handle is an object still, but it's telling you something, it's saying something by having a handle or having no handle.
Yeah. Function.
Yeah. It's a story. It might not be the most entertaining story, but it's a story nonetheless. And so kind of like trying to like pinpoint. Yeah. I think that's where we were at. Pinpointing where story is in the world. I think a lot of that comes down to like, how things are designed to tell you something.
Mm-hmm.
At least for me, these are the interesting things that I end up trying to use in my my artwork is how someone can explain something very simply. Like anything that has a handle is telling you something that it can be pulled against. And, you know, so it's like, how can I use that? Or not, I mean, I probably won't, but it's the idea of, can I use a handle as an idea for an entrance to something or an exiting of something or whatever, but it's really pinpointing what holds a narrative and then seeing if I can end up using that to explain something.
I see. Yeah. That reminds, I was just actually watching some of those masterclass, and I was watching the one with David Lynch, which actually turned out to be pretty fantastic.
Are they paid for podcasts?
No, they're not. Not at all. But if you use this code at checkout. but no, he said something like, I love that simplicity like you're talking about. And he had this example. He was talking about, I think it's when he did Eraserhead, but he was talking, you know, to you, what you're saying too, about going left when it seems like you should go right.
Right.
He used this example of, when usually when somebody leaves a room, it's cut scene, right? And then you go to the next one or you go to another area or something like that. And it was the first time on Eraserhead, he tried this thing where somebody left the room and then he decided to linger on that room that they just left, the door shut in like 10 seconds of an empty room. And he outright says, he's like, that's a very different story. Now the room becomes a character in a way. And it's an entirely different story. And that person who left is no longer, you know, of importance.
Right. Yeah.
I thought it was amazing.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, it's being kind of aware of that. Even when you watch movies, I think when you really pay attention to story, you start noticing the tools that they use, you know, whether it be, I don't know, the color palette or whatever, but there always seems to be, am I banging again? There always seems to be.
You have been the whole time, but it's okay.
Oh yeah. So the idea is like, just kind of being aware of story and how things are, all of a sudden your brain like opens up and you start really noticing a lot of interesting things that you might not have noticed, such as like how a door handle can say something or, and then leading that back to how you can use it, or obviously we have like warm and cool tones that we all play with. And, you know, obviously that helps tell the story and things like this that you, if you like, David Lynch, right? Not sure if it was
Fincher. Hasselhoff.
I get him and Fincher, David Fincher.
Oh, okay. Stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, how they decide to tell a story. That was one of the interesting things with the Parasite story, like when, or movie, when you watch it.
Spoiler alert. I haven't seen it.
You haven't?
No, because I haven't. I just was able to procure a copy that has subtitles.
Oh, nice.
I couldn't find one with subtitles.
Yeah, but definitely the house plays is a character. The camera is a character in the story. Like all these things are helping to tell the story, and they feel like they are a presence. Not necessarily just a house, but like they feel like they've contributed just as much to the story as the actors in the story.
I see. And, yeah.
And no spoilers, just the fact that how it's done, you really can see how a person who's really thinking about these things can elevate a story if they're, you know, really aware and really kind of focused on how a story can be told outside of words and the simplest form of connecting dots, although you have to connect dots most of the time. But
right. Yeah, he's an amazing storyteller, Bong Joon-ho.
What else did he do?
He did Snowpiercer, The Host, I think it was.
Okay, yeah, he's awesome. I didn't know that. Those are like, Snowpiercer is English, right?
Yeah, that was his, I might be wrong, but I think it was his only American film.
Yeah.
With Captain America.
I don't know. It's funny because it's a weird thing where like I didn't want to watch that movie just because he was in it, but it's,
you don't like Chris Evans or you don't like Captain America?
It's just There's something about him being Captain America where it's like, I can't get past that a lot of times. In general, I mean, with a lot of the actors that are superheroes, it's like, once you're a superhero,
I know,
I can't see you outside of the costume.
Yeah.
Must be a weird life.
Embrace yourself, because now every A-list actor wants to be in a Marvel movie. Yeah. So you're not going to be able to watch anybody anymore.
Crazy. I'm all right with that.
I'm tired of those movies, man. For the reason that we're talking about, funny enough, because I think it's topical, is I feel like they've completely sacrificed story. I mean, they're terrible interpretations of comic books. Yeah. It's all about like the special effects and who the actor or actress is now, you know?
Right. There's little glimpses of hope. Like every once in a while, a Batman will come out that's pretty dark and all right. And you're like, all right, that was dark and all right. Or I don't know how you felt about Joker. It seemed, I don't know if that's a comic.
Oh, favorite movie of the year. Yeah. Probably. Yeah, it was amazing. And I went into it, I didn't want to like it because the Killing Joke comic is one of my favorite comics. And for the simple reason, too, the thing that's always been effective about the Joker is you don't know his origins. So I was like, I don't want to see an origin story. But I thought they did it great justice. You both liked it?
Yeah, we both really liked it. That, and I mean, last year was good movies in general, I think.
What were some of your favorites? To get slightly off topic,
the Hollywood Once Upon a Time in Hollywood,
great movie.
The Parasite movie I really enjoyed. What else? But those are like my top three. Like I was like, wow, those are there's movies that just kind of I think are just really, really great, and they seem to come very rarely. And to have three movies that I thought were insanely good all in one year, I'm like, doesn't beat that. I mean, it's like that.
Yeah. Cause all those were very high quality. Well, I haven't seen Parasite, but the level of good, cause usually you'll sneak in some mediocre ones and Oscar baity, and then there'll be like one that's like, yeah, that was pretty compared to everything else.
Yeah. But I don't know, whatever. It's funny. Cause when we apply for murals, my name is so white sounding.
It is. I never thought about that.
And MJ, she goes by MJ Lindo, but I was like, her actual name is Maria Jose Lindo. So I was like, you need to start writing Maria Jose Lindo so we can get
some woke. You need to up that woke game.
You got the two most Latin names as your first name. So
don't you have a nickname? No one gave you a nickname as a kid? Well, what was your email?
L Thumbs.
There you go.
What was the nickname? Yeah, and I have like, because I'm half Tongan, so like my Tongan side, they all call me Siwa. Or Sasiwa is like my actual Josh in Tongan. But I don't know. I'm fine with my name.
Sorry to cut you off, but that was something I wanted to ask, because a few months ago, you guys were still working on a mural in Oregon. Were you able to finish it, or did this cut you guys off?
No, so we haven't even started yet. We were just about to head there. The week everything kicked off was the day or the week we were supposed to take off to Oregon to start the mural. We were going to paint, I think, 3 weeks. We took off work to do, but then
Damn. Then
all this happened, and we're like, never mind. And then we were in communications with them, hoping that we can still figure that out or figure out what the next steps are, but I haven't figured that out.
Yeah.
But it is what it is. We're still going to do it. It just pushed back like everyone else's life to whenever.
Yeah. Everybody's on pause.
Yeah. It's a weird,
weird world. But you guys are, planning, right? To do more like this kind of your.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know you've played around with murals, and there's something great about them. There's also something challenging about them, which is, you know, most of what I think most artists do, we kind of zone out any outside influence, and or at least hopefully, and then we try to create in that environment. But with murals, there is a bit of thinking about the surroundings and thinking about, you know, how this might affect someone and having that influence. I don't know if it waters down the work, but you have to kind of figure out how to be creative. You have to figure out how to make PG-13 movies when you want to make
Right, right.
Horror movies.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I mean, in a way, yeah, you're right. I think you're absolutely right, because in a way, it's almost a collaboration. Like, everybody owns it.
Yeah. So that's been the trickiest part. But we definitely want to pursue murals, because it's something we extremely enjoy and want to get good at. But we just, it's just, it's like everything. There's a learning curve to it, it seems like. And I don't know if there's going to be a, I don't know, like a, I don't know what to call it, like kind of like a step by, like a, like we're not, I don't know if we're going to have like a game book of how to knock out murals without having the sass of a city come at us. But
I was just going to say, the other thing is all the bureaucracy and administrative hurdles, to put it lightly.
We did one in our town, and we did it about a block from our house, and we live in like a very Latin based neighborhood. And some lady who lives in like the really rich area of our neighborhood, she like stirred up a huge pot of sass that we had to like deal with for a
for long. Why that had to do with the imagery?
Yeah, so, well, we think there was a bit of like malice intent when it came to why, what her intention. So the, I don't know if you've seen it, but there's just this, we painted a wall pink and then had like a luchador fighting, like a dark ominous luchador type figure fighting like this young girl, kind of like a David Goliath type story.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we just got a full on community backlash kicked up by a lady whose job it was to, she runs like a organization that tries to set up murals for artists.
Okay.
And she was the one that kicked up all the dust, and she kicked it up like the day we started. And we assume that the reason is because she was just mad that we got that wall.
So, okay. A little wall envy.
That was a weird, it's weird when you start doing these things, you realize how many people, I don't know, I'm sure you probably know Amanda Lynn. Mm-hmm. I talked with her and she's like, yeah, that happens every time you get a wall. Someone will say, why did you get this wall? How did you get this wall? And it's like, the fact of the matter is, if you pursue trying to get a mural on a wall, then you'll, you know, and you get it, then you got it. But most of these people don't go a route of getting anything. They're just kind of sitting around, fingers crossed or something like that, hoping.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
On their lap. But I'm just lucky enough to have MJ. She's like a full on go getter when it comes to this kind of stuff.
Oh, is she? She's the charge. She's the charging bull in this.
She's emailing nonstop every day. And
that's awesome.
And I'm just sitting back like
thinking about stories. Exactly. Looking for movies online. that means you guys are a good team.
Yeah. Someone's gotta think of stories, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Why, how come how did it work out when you guys started pursuing them together? Because so far that I've seen, I mean, you guys, I don't know, your team in some respects, but you've pursued your own careers as painters separately. Right.
Well, we're just kind of learning as we go. So the hope is that we get enough work where we can kind of run our own little projects. But as for now, it's like if there's a wall where I created a design for, it doesn't hurt that MJ's attached to it and kind of able to learn and point out maybe an idea that I didn't think of for the process or vice versa. So working it as a team right now seems to be a very helpful thing. But in the long run, I think we want to be able to kind of detach at some point if the work is there, and hopefully have the, you know, the ability to run our own mural without needing each other. Or
Okay.
But it's all just kind of learning as a group idea, which I don't mind at all. I mean, there's definitely some learning curve.
Do you guys have any more lined up?
So we have like two smaller private ones for a guy who, I don't know what he does, but he's very rich. And then we're supposed to do one for a brewery and local brewery coming up.
Oh, okay. Is that the one that you got? Did you both do beer cans for them? I know MJ did.
MJ did. They want me to, and I probably will at some point, but it's just, I haven't gotten to it. Yeah. It's just time. I should probably do it, actually.
I think you guys are especially you, the hardest working people I know. Because you're doing a full-time job, you maintain painting, and you do the podcast, and now you're pursuing murals.
I'm exhausted.
Dude, you gotta be.
Yeah. But
you're just amazing at time management? Like,
I'm pretty good at it, way better at it than MJ. MJ's like, she's late to everything.
Yeah.
And that's like the simplest form of time management. But yeah, I try to be I try to think of a year and then think of how I have to pace myself in order to keep that up. I think art's probably the trickiest one.
Yeah.
And now that we're doing murals, trying to figure out how to work in that time. The hope is that we can get to a point where quitting the full-time job gets to be an easy jump. If we get enough mural work, because, you know, the great thing about mural work is that it's guaranteed money. It's once you have the job that you can count on that money being there.
Yeah, it's straight commerce. Isn't that the terrible thing? I always think with painting, man, like doing shows, I just feel like it's just like going into a casino. You spend all this time, you put everything on the wall, and then it's like, and just wait. Oh, man.
So true. God, I never thought about that, but that's exact. You're like, I figured out the combination to get the winning.
Yeah.
I got a system.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then exactly. So yeah, that's the benefit of mural stuff is that you just kind of, once things are locked in place, as long as coronavirus don't screw things up, then you'll be all right to like plan your year out financially as well, not just art, not just trying to create whatever you're trying to create and fingers crossed gamble.
Right. Right.
But this is a way to really kind of set your year up so that if we can set up a year, so we know we'll be financially stable, then we can hop off a job and give ourselves 8 hours each a day. It's like we just worked on this mural together. It's like a Aztec background with like a Latin lady with a hat.
I saw the post of that.
And we were keeping track of the time to figure out how much time it took to do that mural versus like the days because of our schedule. And it ended up being like, I think 10 hours is what we spent fully on the mural. But it was broken up into, I don't know, 5 days or something like that.
Yeah, different sessions.
So it's like if I can work a 10-hour day on a mural, or me and MJ, so I guess it'd be 20 hours total because there's two of us. But the idea is if we get a small mural like that and work together, we can knock it out in a day rather than right now a week. And so if you line up enough.
Yeah, do it in a sitting and then you have all that money in one shot.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the business end of what we do and kind of figuring out that side of the mural game. But it's exciting for sure to be able to have that, like much more financial stability, if you can set it up right, rather than, you know, art, which is who knows. It's great. It's
the gallery model you're talking about. Yeah.
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 I mean, the hope is that most people are probably thinking outside the gallery model for some chunk of money. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying all galleries must close, but I think you should probably be thinking of how to pursue financial endeavors outside of a gallery, unless you're blessed with a good gallery setup.
Unless you're Damien Hirst or.
Yeah.
Jeff Koons. What do you think? Not that I want to like revolve around Corona or like the easy topics or questions, but I'm really worried about and trying to project is what's the landscape going to look like after this?
Yeah, I think that's the tricky bit is predicting what we're going to look like in 6 months, especially for art. I think everyone that had art shows is going to be pushed back 6 months. So if you had I had an art show in New York in like the end of the year at some point, but it's like, I don't know, in a weird way, I'm like, this might be a positive for me because I might end up having a show in a nice month.
Right.
But it's still a huge, like, what's going to happen and what am I creating work for at this point? But I don't know. I think a lot of people should probably start thinking of if there is something that they can do on this big internet thing we have to maybe find some financial independence in some way. I think having that mindset might be who we might see at the end be a bit more successful as artists.
Right. Yeah. It feels like there's going to be, it's like that, it sounds a little harsh to put it this way, but like separating the wheat from the chaff. You know?
Yeah. I mean, it's really going, and I know it's kind of hard, that whole like business mindset of it. We all just kind of want to paint and hand that over to the galleries. That's like the dream scenario. So we don't have to deal with all that, you know, marketing aspects of what galleries do and the wheeling and dealing that they do. But I think a lot of people have to really start kind of figuring out if they're willing to put their hat in the race for that whole end of what we kind of do nowadays.
Right.
You know what I'm realizing is that when I listen to your podcast and all the Europeans are on, they talk so fucking beautifully and
they have beautiful grammar, huh? I feel like a moron. That's why I don't talk a lot when I have European guests.
They have beautiful grammar. They talk about deep mental mindset. I'm just like, door handles and business. So American.
We're definitely a different breed, the Americans. I feel it, man.
Yeah, I mean, it is what it is. I just watched Killing Me Softly again. You know that movie? It's like Brad Pitt's assassin.
I don't think I've seen it.
Really?
Yeah.
It came out a while ago. I don't know I'm not sure who directed it, but but there's a moment at the end where Brad Pitt just says, he's like talking to a guy who tries to underpay him around a recession for killing people. And spoiler alert, by the way. And he goes on, like, it's like the pinnacle of the thing. And he's just like, America's not a country, it's a business. And I was like, God damn, he's not wrong.
He's not wrong at all. And I think what's going on in the States right now is kind of highlights it. When you see a pandemic and it's all become about money there, that's been the interesting thing here. There's no, I mean, socialism, if you want to call it that, I just hate using the word now to Americans because they think it's communism, but it has its drawbacks, but right. Man, it's been so much easier in some ways here.
Yeah. My job, they called me, I don't know if I said this, but they called me and they wanted me to work today.
Yeah.
And it's like, I thought it was justified to shut down 3 weeks ago when we had like a single case in our city, you know, and like, I think like 1,000 cases maybe in America or something like that. And it's like, and now we have over 400,000 cases and you're like, hey, can you come back to work? I'm like, no, what the, I'm not going to, maybe you should have waited to shoot your load, but.
No regard for health.
No, not at all. And, you know, it's like, okay, so the bottom dollar is okay if, you know, is more important than risking people's health and life. So I don't know if you listened to Sam Harris's podcast at all, but he had the guy on.
Oh, yeah. Premium.
Yeah. You know the Squarespace.
Oh, yeah. I haven't listened to the episode, though.
But it was interesting because his business is set up so that there's no central office. Everyone just works from their home or wherever. And that's the entire company set up that way. So it was like, it was just interesting to hear how his business isn't affected at all through this whole thing. It's because he set it up in a way where there was no office to go to or anything like that.
Yeah. And we're definitely going to see a lot more of that business or business models will change the working environment.
Yeah. It'll be interesting how many people aren't going to go to work or businesses are going to try to change their way of structure. Cause it makes sense. Cause then you save money on a facility as well.
Yeah. On your overhead. Hey, you want to answer? I did get a couple of questions. I tried that. I don't know how you guys did it. I did want to talk a little about your podcast. I think we're running out of time. But so somebody was asking, well, it's to both of us, but what made the difference to both of you in terms of getting better as artists? Was it persistence, teachers, brush mileage, books, etc.?
Yeah. I mean, for me, at least, it's a lot of practice. And I mean, it just comes down to practicing and practicing in the right direction. I think that's most of what makes people better is figuring out what makes, you know, like, I mean, a lot of it's been YouTube probably for me.
I was going to ask what your sources were as a self-taught artist.
Yeah. I mean, and even that was like, I feel like after, I started paying attention to YouTube stuff maybe like 3 years ago. I was like, oh, that's a cool little tip. It taught me the basis of what I do, but it's almost like a honing thing, you know, like the honing, whatever for the knives, when you have a knife, you have the thing and you go like this, shink, shink, shink.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The sharpener thing.
It's called a honing something.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah. I didn't know what it's called. The idea is that the knife isn't dull because it doesn't sharpen a knife. It just straightens the like blade. So there's like little bends in the blade. And what it does is, and so that's what I feel like those YouTube videos are. They kind of like hone you in a little bit tighter than maybe if you, I don't know how to explain it. It's like a teeth cleaning or some shit.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, it's not really teaching me much. It's just reminding me of things that I might not be doing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Kind of like clearing the path just a tiny bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe.
Yeah. 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 But yeah, I think that's all it is. It's just kind of a lot of practice going in a good direction. I always tell people like learn value, learn block in technique, learn like little things here and there that might like all of a sudden make you get at least a chunk better.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. This one was really long, so I'm trying to figure out how to paraphrase it or whittle it down. I think essentially what this person's asking is, how do you develop a cohesive body of work?
I think this, at least for me, goes back to like story and just kind of having something worth saying and then figuring out how you want to say it is the next step and then having the skills to execute it. I think it just reads cohesively if you kind of have the I don't know. I mean, you can also do it with color and style and I don't know, a plethora of different reasons probably, but at least for me, when I'm at least especially now, I really have an overall idea of how I'm going to pursue something. So how I was saying earlier about the objects in motion or object, you know, an object in one place or object colliding, like the work I'm working on now, it's based around just these three narratives and really figuring out what stories I want to tell within those three and how to make them interesting. But that's the theme about this one. And then earlier I talked about the Bukowski poem and just kind of having that as the anchor for the work, you know, it's just, I don't know, finding the story to, at least for me, that's how I anchor my group bodies of work. How do you do it?
I mean, I feel like if you just keep doing it, like for me, it's like a lot of less looking at art and more doing helps me do that. Cause I feel like even like we were talking earlier, even if I'm not trying to pick something up. Cause I remember like as a student, one of the ways we were taught and everybody does this is like looking at other artists, like how did they, and as troubleshooting, like how did Sargent paint a hand? How did so-and-so paint an eye? And then you take it, but then eventually you lose it and it becomes your own. Mm-hmm. But I find out cause there's so much access to it that I stop looking at painting and then just paint so that I'm troubleshooting myself. It's way too, that's why I don't scroll on Instagram anymore. I'll look at the first three and then I'm off.
Nice.
You know, because I think I'm too, I think that's another thing too. I think what I think is the downside of being schooled, at least for me, I guess not for everybody, because something I've really learned doing this, talking to self-taught artists, is they don't generally have a problem finding their voice. You guys tend to find it early on. And I think when you go to school a lot of the times, because you're taught how to paint so many different things, that painting becomes troubleshooting, not expression. It's like, okay, how do I paint this certain light on a grape? How do you get that little subsurface scattering, you know, in a piece of fruit or whatever? And then you do that. So anytime you see something, your brain's automatically like, oh, I know how to paint that. And you do it, you know? And I think that can be a detriment.
Yeah. It's also like, I think that as far as the voice, one thing I've noticed kind of in the similar vein is like a lot of schooled artists, they just never kind of built that mentality of what you're trying to say. It's like me in my development or whatever, it was always kind of what I'm trying to say and then how to do that was always kind of the process. What I'm trying to say and how do I do it, it was like first two steps, but it doesn't, so kind of building the voice was always built into the process. But I think when you're schooled, it's so heavily influenced on technique, and even with the schools that aren't heavily influenced on technique, it doesn't seem like they're really trying to focus on what to say and how to say it. They're more like, you know, a little wonky brain and being like, be a free spirit and fly like an eagle.
Yeah, because I think I think I probably read this somewhere recently, but at the end of the day, with art, the only way you can teach art, which my thing is you can't. I don't think you can teach art. But if you're going to, all you can teach is technique.
Going back to the whole Bob Dylan thing, you know, it's like, you can't teach that. It just kind of, it's just a person saying something in a way that he says it. And he obviously had to be trained or learn how to play guitar, you know, but it's, there's still like a, I think his voice led his actions probably, or what he was trying to say.
Yeah.
His music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody else asked, and I think this is an inside joke, what kind of pencil do you use?
God damn it. God.
This is a waiting to dry thing?
This is, it wasn't a waiting to dry thing.
Well, I mean, you talk about it on waiting to dry. Yeah.
It's an Instagram thing where anytime I draw, no matter what I'm drawing with, it's always, what pencil is that? And it's like, it doesn't matter.
I think what the equivalent is, but it probably matters a little bit more, is, since I've been posting all the Procreate stuff, I always get, what brushes are you using? And maybe that's the equivalent of it.
Yeah, but even then, it's like, go in the art store and start cheap and play around and figure out like at least the type of brush you might enjoy.
Yeah.
And then if you want to go fancier, but at least you know, I like rounds or I like flats or I like filberts or whatever you're into.
Yeah.
But start off cheap or buy one of those cheapy sets and just play around with each brush and firmness and then figure, it's like, it doesn't matter what brush I'm using because you might hate those brushes, but people are silly. They're always looking for an answer.
Agreed. All right, man, I got to wrap this up because we're almost 9 o'clock here. I feel like we can go on for a couple more hours, man. It's almost a 2-hour conversation. You want to do it again sometime?
Damn. Yeah. Anytime.
Thanks for coming on.
I got you, John.
Lo-Fi Sight and Sound Podcast is an American artist living in Paris, France, in conversation with artists, musicians, and filmmakers discussing context, the creative process, and studio practice. You can find us on all streaming platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Also at www.lofipodcast.com, no hyphens. Please rate and review. It helps more than you know. If you can't rate and review, then please share this with a friend. Lo-Fi Podcast is recorded, mixed, and edited by myself. Intro music is also by me. Thank you for listening.